Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
Here we are with just about 4 days left in the 2010s. The decade started with President Obama in office. Democrats had huge majorities in both the House and Senate. It ends with President Trump in office, Democrats back in control of the House, and Republicans with a slight majority in the Senate. But the 2010s have been about a lot more than politics. And joining us to look at that is Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic. Hi, Derek.
Great to be here. Thank you, Jeremy.
And so many things have happened in the 2010s, and we've sort of narrowed them down to several categories. But let's start with the economy, which is something that you pay a lot of attention to. We've been through so much in this decade. What has this decade meant for the U.S. economy?
Well, across categories, I think it's been a Rashomon decade, a decade where, depending on how you choose to look at it, things look very, very different. So in terms of the economy, it's absolutely been a Rashomon decade. It's been one of the best decades the past half century, or it's been utterly dreadful. So on the bright side, unemployment's about 3.5%. That's extremely low, one of the lowest in 60 years. Wage growth is accelerating for the low income. We've added jobs for more consecutive months than any period in American history. Consumer sentiment is high. Inflation is low. Stocks have tripled in the last 10 years. This is pretty cool if you've been lucky enough to have savings in corporate equities. So altogether, it really seems like a pretty strong economy heading into the next decade. On the other hand, there's this dark side. You don't have enough homes that are being built, and as a result, millennials and Gen Z don't have a chance to build wealth the same way that older generations have. It's created this angry and politically motivated young cohort that feels, I think rightly so, like it's been somewhat screwed over by the Great Recession and its aftermath. You still have really high poverty, high poverty rates for working families, high poverty rates for children that haven't been ameliorated by this long recovery. So it's this rare decade that's been all growth and no recession, but it's not entirely clear how good it's been for tens of millions of people in the lower rungs. So again, a Rashomon decade.
But whether the decade has been good or bad for you economically, you're almost certainly addicted to your mobile device. So let's talk about the decade in technology. There's been so much technological change. I remember I got my first iPhone, first smartphone, really, back in 2008, right before this decade. But let's listen back to the man who was behind that, Apple CEO Steve Jobs, who passed away this decade. And here he is speaking in 2010, a year before he died, at the All Things Digital Conference, talking about what he and his employees do.
We come into work wanting to do the same thing today as we did 5 or 10 years ago, which is build the best products for people. You know, there's nothing that makes my day more than getting an email from some random person in the universe who just bought an iPad over in the UK and tells me the story about how it's the coolest product they've ever brought home, you know, in their lives. That's what keeps me going.
Derek, Steve Jobs could certainly see into the future to some degree, but I think even he would be surprised at how much we are relying on his devices and devices like them when it comes to Uber, maps, mobile payments, et cetera. What has this decade meant for technology?
It's been a decade of magic and a decade of great disappointment. So again, I think there's two ways you can look at this. You can look at the fact that smartphones have become clearly the most important, most consequential consumer product maybe in the last 50 years, maybe in human history, when you think about all the things that someone can do with their smartphone, that they can read the news, that they can send money, that it's not just replacing, you know, newspapers and magazines in the U.S., it's replacing banking systems across Africa. So on the one hand, you have this magic that's been unleashed by the smartphone, social media, app world. At the same time, I think this has been a decade of tremendous disappointment in the tech community. And you can think of it as the tech's sins of commission and sins of omission. Hmm. So the sins of commission we talk about all the time. It's Facebook and misinformation. It's the privacy scandals regarding our smartphones and the Internet of Things. It's the dangerously narcotizing effects of social media, not just on your, you know, average adult, but especially on young teenagers. But I also, this month in The Atlantic, focused on the sins of omission among the tech community. in many ways, since the invention of the smartphone, or at least the iPhone, over a decade ago, has actually been a surprisingly stagnant decade, I think, technologically speaking. A lot of the things that we were promised, whether it was AI or self-driving cars or automation, they didn't materialize. And what we got instead are a lot of apps that make our life slightly more convenient, whether it's, you know, Uber or Lyft or DoorDash, but don't dramatically transform the city. I would argue that Silicon Valley in many ways has sunk a lot of talent and treasure in the last decade into solving problems that just don't matter that much, like advertising technology. And I think they would say, well, look, it's difficult to make a profit trying to transform the physical world. And I would agree with them. It is difficult and expensive to try to transform the physical world, but still they have failed. So, you know, this depresses me somewhat. I say this as a criticism of Silicon Valley, but I also say it as a means of galvanizing them. I think America is better off being technologically optimistic. And I think that in many ways, this decade was strange and paradoxical in that smartphones became ubiquitous, but so did an element of tech pessimism.
I have to say that I feel a little bit guilty now just about every time I look at social media, that I'm wasting minutes of my life looking at this thing that if I were to miss it, it doesn't really matter.
Yeah, it's the way that I put it in my column for The Atlantic is that for the last 10 years, we have seen an industrial revolution in convenience. And I mean that in a good and bad way. I mean an industrial revolution in convenience in terms of Google conveniently organizes all the world's information. And you look at Uber, Lyft, how in the world could you argue that that hasn't made getting around a city more convenient? But I am hoping for an industrial revolution in something more than convenience in the next decade or in the next generation. I think we need more technology around energy generation and energy storage, more technology around advancing artificial intelligence, and more technology to sort of revitalize the physical world. It both astonishes and somewhat depresses me that when you go outside and you look at skyscrapers and cars and you hear planes overhead and feel the rumble of the subway below your feet, these are all inventions of the late 19th century.
Right.
These are 130-year-old inventions. Let's invent something new for the physical environment in the next generation and not just add more software to our phones.
All right, Derek, let's talk about another topic that you spend a lot of time thinking about, and that is entertainment. At the start of the decade, the Academy Award for Best Picture went to The Hurt Locker, a film about an American bomb disposal team in the Iraq War.
You realize every time you suit up, it's life or death.
And fast forward to today.
Bounty hunting is a complicated profession.
That is from The Mandalorian on Disney's new streaming service, Disney Plus. So much has changed, you know, the rise of... Were we still getting Netflix DVDs mailed to us at the beginning of the decade? I can't remember.
I think some of us were. Some of us were streaming. But if we were streaming, we were streaming shows and movies that Netflix didn't own. 10 years ago, Netflix did not have any original content. But since Netflix made the decision about a decade ago to buy original content, like House of Cards, it has transformed the entire visual entertainment world. And now it is obvious to everybody that the future of TV and film will be streamed. On the one hand, yes, Disney still does release $1 billion blockbusters, it seems like, every 3 months. It just released another one that will surely earn $1 billion in the last Star Wars movie. But Disney has gotten into the streaming wars with Netflix, and it is a crowded space. Amazon is there. Apple is there. NBC is there. Time Warner with HBO is jumping in. And so you really see that the cable bundle, which was in many ways one of the most important cultural totems of the second half of the 20th century, is being undercut by a future that will be streamed. And that will have just absolutely fascinating implications for advertising. And it also, I think, has really important implications for how America thinks of itself as being sort of a single nation or community when it comes to entertainment. You know, 90 million of us, 100 million of us used to watch sitcoms and dramas, and now we all stream from one of several hundred new dramas that come out on a variety of streaming sites. So we are becoming fragmented, not only politically, but also in terms of our entertainment.
But there's so much good TV out there right now, I must say.
There is.
With all of this change happening over the last decade, of course, a lot of the attention has just been on politics, not just in this country, but around the world. And in terms of what's next, you ask, is this the beginning of a Cold War between the U.S. and China? What do you think?
I don't know, Jeremy, but it concerns me what we're seeing right now between the U.S. and China. I think on the one hand, you have a United States that doesn't really know entirely what it stands for, that is deeply polarized between a far right or at least a conservative wing that is dominated by white voters and a socialist wing of the Democratic Party that is more diverse, but that is young and angry and stands for very little of that which the sort of Trumpist wing of the Republican Party is standing for. So I think that the U.S. is at least politically at each other's throats. And at the same time, you see that China itself might be sort of coming apart at the seams between Hong Kong and the fact that the Chinese government from Beijing is waging essentially a kind of genocide against the Uyghur population in Xinjiang. It has its own internal problems. So, you know, a lot of times when people focus on, you know, the geopolitical showdown between the U.S. and China, they focus on the relationship between the U.S. and China. But I think many of the things that are driving the insecurity of this relationship is the fact that each of these countries are going through their own political turmoil internally.
That is Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic. Derek, thanks so much, as always, and Happy New Year.
Jeremy, Happy New Year. You got that dream, daydream, look in your eye, and I got the red lip
classic thing that you like, and when we go crashing. So how would you describe this past decade? Tell us what you'll be remembering at hereandnow.org.